Hi everybody, today's Monday, October 28th, and we're having Daniel with us to talk about the changes that are happening in the Middle East. How's it going, Daniel?
Good, good. Thanks for having me.
And let's talk about the latest, this Israeli attack on Iran. What was the importance of this attack in the eyes of Israelis, in your opinion?
In the eyes of Israel?
Israel, yeah.
I guess it's to say that they followed through on their threat that Iran can't attack them without fear of retribution, and that they have the will and the power to, strike back, I guess, or... It's hard to say in in retrospect, isn't it? I mean, what were they thinking? That's the question that goes both ways. Like, I mean, you can ask me, but I'm asking myself, like, how can this have been a good idea? I can't imagine why you would, you know, challenge someone to a race that you were destined to lose. Why would you do that? Especially if it's your choice. They didn't have to do it. You know, they felt from their feeling of supremacy, or they, how dare Iran do this and they're going to pay. And it's kind of like, well, where's the, okay. I don't want to say it too loud because I don't want them to continue or anything, but the obvious question is, well, where's the payment? I don't really get it, you know?
Yeah. And when you look at Antony Blinken's visit to Israel, in your opinion, that was the Israeli attack on Iran was coordinated by the Biden administration, or how successful, let's put it this way, how successful was the Biden administration in putting some sort of pressure on Netanyahu administration not to go that big on Iran?
I don't think they were successful at all. I think the failure has to do with the facts on the ground, with the kind of difference in how parties view history, basically, and how things go in the humans. And you have the people who are only accusing us of being vermin, for being on the wrong side of history, of not espousing human concerns like logic, fallibility, a third party view of what's going on. I see it as an incredible failure on, and I'm not really talking just about Israel or Israel's attack on Iran. I'm talking about a much broader view, which this is to say, the complete collapse, I think, of the PR war, of the overall sense of where things are. It's not for nothing that this happened in the same week as Kazan, you know, as what is happening in Ukraine. This is happening everywhere and at once, and that's how shifts take place. They may seem incremental. You know, you can look at seismology, you can look at tiny cracks in a fault line, you know, and you can say, oh, wow, that was a tremor. Wow, come it's the same to the north of LA as it is to the south of San Diego. What's happening? And then boom, it all happens at once. And I really feel that you have to back up in order to look at this correctly. I think that what we're looking at is Ukraine and Israel are two enormous blackheads or heads of color, I guess maybe we should say, to be politically correct, on the acne-encrusted face of U.S. NATO. They're the things that stick out, the things that get the attention. But this is a much bigger iceberg, if you will. And this is a kind of exposure of what's going on and has been going on underneath for decades. And all of a sudden, they're running out of steam. I don't mean that they don't have weapons left. Of course they do. But they certainly have no moral impetus. They have no compassion or empathy left with the rest of the world. The PR war, the psychological warfare that they've been engaged in for so long has been kind of unmasked as the psychotic warfare that it was from the beginning. And there's no way that you can put that genie back in the bottle. No way ever, never will Israel gain the moral upper hand in any sense of the word. And behind them, of course, is the United States, who's doing all this with on the shoulders of their imperial brethren, the English, for many, many years, and have always managed to paint it their own way, have always managed to paint the other guy in a corner and say, well, it had to invade India and subjugate the masses in order to civilize them and save women from sati and all that crap that they've been spouting. It's not overnight. This has been, and that's what's so interesting, is that they learn so little and so late that they've been winning that war for decades, for centuries. The war of law, of supposed legitimacy, of the moral compass. And it was crap when Columbus did it, 500 years ago, and it's crap now. And all of a sudden, people are starting to stop in their tracks and say, like, we'll just get back at Iran. How? You're not a peer. There's no such thing. Israel has never fought its peers, meaning Israel as a proxy of the U.S. Ukraine is a proxy of the U.S. and is fighting a peer of the U.S., the Russian military. And what you get in both cases is absolute failure. It's just, and it's not right now. It's in almost in I don't know, quasi-religious terms or ideological terms. Like, that's not how you get what you want. What is Iran going to do now? Who cares? Iran is going to do Iran. What they're going to do is keep doing what they've been doing, continue on the path that they are on, and worry less about an invasion from the U.S. and attacks from Israel. Because what is amazing is that Israel and its Western sponsors are constantly looking for, the Russians are going to attack. Lithuania put up some, tank barriers on bridges. Like, they're making up this threat completely from the ground up. Iran has no interest in taking over the rest of the Middle East in Israel. They want to be left to themselves. They want to do what they want to do. And so does Russia. And what they're fighting is the absolutely insufferable need on the part of the West to control everything, to take forcibly the results, the profits from what they do, the control over what they do, all the ways in which they talk, sing, think, feel, spit, shit, whatever. Everything they do, everything has to be controlled by the West for its own continued hegemony. And if you get out of that optometry, out of the lens of that magnifying glass, it's your first thing is, whew, so, oh my God, that wasn't really real? That was all fake? They were making that. I always thought, you know what? My older brother told me he was going to beat me up if I didn't do X, Y, Z. I grew up and I looked around and I said, oh my God, he's an idiot. He doesn't have any control over me. He doesn't even know what he's doing. This is amazing. And this is, I think, what is a remarkable kind of a breakthrough on the part of the rest of the world. And I don't see it as a, you know, like a belief kind of like they're all in sync or something. But I think it is the nature of change. I would say that we are moving into a phase of punctuation. And that goes back to the theory of evolution with Darwin's explanation. And then when I was in college, I took classes from Stephen Jay Gould, who came up with the idea of punctuated equilibrium, which is you can't find all these intermediate species. Remember the missing link, all that crap that they went through? Darwin has to be wrong because we can't find the missing link. We have chimney man and this man and that man. And what Gould and Eldridge came up with, which technically has to do with evolution, but I'm using it because its grounding is in the nature of change in organic systems. Change happens suddenly and dramatically, and then nothing. Equilibrium. This is what you can look at anything. Why do kids? Kids will grow half an inch overnight. This happens. Pediatricians have said this forever. Not every night. Then they don't grow forever. Same with grass. Same with every organic process that you look at. And now, like I said about the seismic thing, where you have tiny tremors along the length of this whole fault, eventually you have wham, a shift. And that is what I think we're on the cusp of, that all of the people who have been stepped on can wake up and say, wait a minute, so we can use something other than the dollar. Yeah, you can use your own money. Yeah, sure. Okay, and we can use a system other than SWIFT. Yeah, you know, whatever. You can do, you know, so we don't have to go by their rules if we want to, like, sell and buy things with each other. No, I mean, well, we can agree on it. We can see. We probably disagree on here and there. But, you know, it's kind of a new thing we got, you know, just kind of make it work. Oh, and you have people, like, emerging from Plato's cave, like, oh, my God. I had no idea that life could be this way. And I think in the same way that the West has completely ignored or under, I think really ignored, underestimated the kind of strength of any opposition to it, is the same way that this is rearing its head now, that they don't really see how endangered their system is. It's really circling the drain in a very real sense, which I don't think is really part of it. They're just looking for, like, they're playing whack-a-mole, that old thing where you beat down, you hit down the things that pop up at the county fair, and you keep smacking them and smacking them, and hopefully they'll all go away. But guess what? They're not going away, you know?
In your opinion, the combination of forces, this balance that you were talking about, or equilibrium, is changing in the Middle East?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely. That's what I mean. The Iranians have been digging, mines for their missiles, which they have developed into an incredibly sophisticated range of ballistic and some hypersonic missiles and defenses that are underground that obviously in incredibly sophisticated air defense systems and have also tried to reach out and increase all of that by uniting with the Russians, with the Chinese on a different level. But they were doing this to ward off the inevitable attack from the empire to protect the revolution. And that's like aiming at I don't know, a 12-foot giant. And then you have some 5-year-old come over from the sandbox and try to take your shovel. Like this is, that's not Israel. They have been defending against the West, collectively against the US. I mean, now look at the balance of forces in this particular thing. You had this Iranian attack that was, I mean, very deft if you look at it from a little bit of hindsight. They didn't attack any occupied centers. They did not like level the air bases and military bases, the Navy before it got out of the harbors and out into the Mediterranean, where it would be beyond their reach. But it was like a tap. They completely overwhelmed the air defense, the vaunted Iron Dome, which turned out to be nothing of the sort, but they didn't create that kind of absolute calamity that they could have. And that was the deterrent message that they were sending. Listen, guys, we can do this, and we can quite obviously do a lot worse. If your air defense systems don't keep out our missiles, they could easily have gone another wave or two. Now, in contrast, Israel doesn't have any missiles. I mean, they have a few, but nothing on that level. They themselves, they said this is what did they did that huge thing about the advanced F-35s. Well, they weren't, and they used 100 of them. First of all, if you're using 100 fighters and that's your delivery system, you're a generation behind. Why? I mean, what is going on in Ukraine? What is going on that the Ansarallah is sending, hypersonic missiles into Tel Aviv? There are no fighter jets involved. Fighter jets need to go through someone else's airspace to get there. So then you have to control Jordan or who or Iraq. What I mean, and if they did use Iraq, what does that mean? That means, like you asked me earlier about the coordination with the Biden administration. Now, is this something that is going to come out? I haven't heard it yet, but I've heard rumors of it. Is that really true? Did the US allow them to fly through Iraqi airspace as if it's their own? And then that with Jordan gives them some sort of advantage. But what advantage? Look at, I mean, we've all seen it now. We've all seen calm aerial views of Tehran at night. We've all seen some of the pinpricks of, it looks like, I told my wife, it looks like a lousy fireworks display, right? They're supposed to be doing this big fireworks show, and it's just pop, pop. Oh, here's one, here's another. Oh, hey, look, honey, there's one. Oh, it's gone. Never mind. Oh, here comes another. Oh, no. And that was it. And what you'd see was, what else were they going to do? And why didn't they? Right? Where is phase two? Why didn't they? Don't you do that to suppress air defense and then come in with a bigger strike? Yada, yada. The Iranians didn't, because they made a big enough statement with the first. They said, if you want, we'll have another wave, but we don't really feel we need one right now. And instead, the Israelis, I mean, it seems almost like it was, they just called it off. You know, they said, well, oh, this isn't really, wow. Because it isn't. I mean, I don't think Iran has the S-500, but they were supposed to get a few S-400s from Russia. But they obviously also had very sophisticated air defense systems of their own that may have been enhanced. Certainly, I think we have to assume that Russia meant what it said, basically. I'm not looking, proof is something that comes down the line. But I think Russia said that they were going to counter the U.S. invasion of Kursk, of Russia proper, not necessarily in Ukraine. And they're strengthening their bonds with Iran and with China, have done exactly that. That's why, you know, Brzezinski and all these old, I don't know, what do you call them, before the neocons, took pre-cons? Were they pre-cons? They said this was the axis to avoid, is Russia, China, Iran. And because they don't really know how they're fighting them, they have lost on many fronts at once. I mean, that is what is so confusing to me, is, if Jordan and Iraq were used in this and can't be, do the trick, then on, I don't know, some philosophical or wacko religious level, Smotrich and these other psychos who say that what no Israel needs to do is take over the whole, you know, what if the greater Israel goes from beyond the Suez over to Iraq and I think probably into Iran. I forget where it goes, but they're not wrong in the most absolute sense of that vulnerability. They cannot not have any enemies in the region if they demand complete and unalterable hegemony and a complete lack of accountability, where they can do anything they want, wherever they want, whenever they want. Yeah, that what you have to do is you have to kill everybody. And guess what? You don't. It's almost like slaves awakening and rattling their chains. Like, wait a minute. No, you can't. You're not going to do that to us again. And I think that after Medvedev was replaced by Putin in Libya, and they said, I mean, he was never president of Libya. I mean, as Russian president, and said that was a mistake, that abstention should have been a veto. And now, when did that happen? It feels like it was a generation ago. I mean, this is only, what, 2011? Was that when it was? I mean, but it seems like a different world. And that is when the BRICS countries are deliberately downplaying their own success, because they want the transition to take place smoothly. No, wait a minute. We're not gonna, whoa. There's no dollar thing, we're not gonna do that. Of course, that's exactly what they're doing, but it will take some time. But we'll see how much time. I mean, you don't really, you don't really know what kind of time you're talking about. And a lot of that is this kind of zoom in and zoom out. Like I like to say about what is now the case, what is being seen now. You look at that, this thing about the PR war, and the simple fact of that thing I sent you about the French, it's an old meme, but it's the thing about the French opinion on who won the war. Who beat the Nazis, right? And of course, 1945, everyone absolutely knew for real that it was the Russians. They had a 10-1 regional advantage in terms of the numbers of legions that they were facing compared to the West. And it was obvious that it could not have happened without that and without the 27 million people that they lost in order to bring it about. But over time, they chiseled away and chiseled away with the help of CIA helping to write World War II movies, right? That the whole thing in Europe started in June of 1944. Like, what kind of bizarre belief is that? But it became the kind of watchword of praising the Americans. And now the reason I bring that up is because they have been working this kind of system that they have honed and been very good at. The propaganda system is a beautiful thing if you like evil. I mean, from the artistry of how deeply that they control, look at the maintenance of this idea of what Israel represents and the supremacy of Israel. First of all, in their own, like Edward Said used to say, Golda Meir said, who are the Palestinians? There are no Palestinians. And then someone else called us rats, and someone called us vermin, and someone called us cockroaches. You know, so pretty soon we're going to get up to the level of mammals or something. We're getting, we're getting more and more advanced. And when the Americans take that over, it's not just calling the vermin or rats. It's saying Israel is indefeatable. And that comes through, it's as silly as it sounds, like in old Seinfeld episodes where someone, I'll get my landlord, he was an Israeli commando, which means, he'll kick your ass because they are the worst. And this is unbelievable. And this has worked its way through American culture wars, for a generation. And once the shine is removed, this is what I'm saying. It works all at once. You can see right through it. They're superior to what? To Gaza? To an enormous incarcerated outdoor prison with people with no access to anything? Well, yeah. And guess what? They're kind of stuck there too. So, and then you move, it's not for nothing that we talk about Ukraine in the same breath, because that's the Americans taking on a peer for the first time. Not Afghans, not Saddam even, who had Soviet era weapons and some, at least some facsimile of an army, but nothing on par, not as a peer to the United States. And that's true in Ukraine now. And they're saying, oops. And I think that just happened in Tehran. Oops. And now what are they going to do? And so I love this other analogy that has to do with optometry. And people who wear glasses will only know what I'm saying. You go to the optometrist and they do that thing where they try a bunch of different lenses. And they say, okay, this one, is it better or worse? Better or worse? Better or worse? And it's zooming in or zooming out. little bit. Does it look better here, this way, or this way? Better or worse? And I think that people's understanding of what is going on depends on perspective in the same way. You're looking at things historically, you're looking at things from a cultural point of view, you're looking at things from a mathematical balance of forces point of view, like you mentioned, and you're looking at the kind of inevitability of history. Like, this was never going to work. And here we are. We finally see it coming to a head. And again, we can't know, but I think that's what's happening.
You've mentioned Kazan and the BRICS summit in Russia. Do you think that the way that they're expanding the relationship between among the countries within BRICS, is that going to help what's going on in the Middle East? We know that Russia and China, we're talking about Palestine and the situation in Palestine. Mm. But to what extent can they help Palestinians, in your opinion? Because right now we have some sort of partnership between Russia and China. Yeah. And between Russia and North Korea. Iran and Russia are going to have a comprehensive agreement. Would that change the balance of power in the Middle East in favor of Palestinians?
I think it's very sad. I think that the ultimate answer immediately is yes. Yes. That will change how things go in the Middle East. But at the same time, we are watching what's happening right now in Jabalila, in North Gaza, in just pictures of a girl carrying her sister down the road. And there is so much happening on the ground in Gaza that we are not even talking about. We're even closer to it. We're talking about Hezbollah in Lebanon. We're talking about Iran. We're talking about Ansarallah. But as we're talking, kids are being slaughtered. And even though Hamas has put up a fight that is absolutely incredible, that the Israelis thought, over a year ago now, they thought that this was a foregone conclusion. And even on that tiny speck of focus, they were dead wrong. But as these things expand outward, it will take time to corral them back into the barn and put all the pieces back together. And I do think that will change the outcome for the Palestinians in the medium run, but not tomorrow. And that's one of the things that I think is very depressing, is to watch what happens right in front of our eyes and to see, I mean, from the point of view of Vietnamese peasants who had to depend on the Viet Cong and who watched napalm, Agent Orange, destroying their houses, farms, giving their children no legs, and this vicious hatred and murderous wave that came over their country. And they had to put their faith or their belief in the supremacy of the people, that they were going to take over their own country and they were going to return. And now, you know, 30 years later, you have 50, I guess, you have China and Vietnam, they're going to open ATMs in Russia. you know, how crazy is that? But I defer to the people themselves. I am amazed by the optimism and affirmation of the Palestinian people, and my heart is with them. But I don't want to say glibly that the change in the balance will help them without killing thousands and thousands more of them before Israel is brought to heel. And that is what I think is going on. That you can't that analogy I just made about you know, Smotrich and Greater Israel, like, that's gone, right? And the less arrogance there is kind of available in your a debit account, right? To do whatever you want, the more your movements are restricted. So as BRICS becomes a real challenge to Western hegemony, it will change the way in which all international conflicts are framed and resolved. And I think I remember feeling this literal like gust of hope when I saw all those leaders getting off the planes and going up to the ones dressed up in their costumes with the cakes and this. And I was just like, this is a new day. This is really happening. But you have to balance that. You have to balance that with, wait a minute, this is still really happening right now. And we can't take our eye off of that. And let's be honest, that is part of what Israel is doing. Because they're trying to say we're always under attack from seven different fronts, right? So what happened to the other thing, though? Just a week ago, you were destroying all of southern Gaza, which you had left as refugee zone. Like, what are you talking? What is that? And part of that is mass, like, diversionary hysteria. And the thing I think it's hard to take seriously is that people who are so vicious and so destructive are actually desperate and in their last throes. You know, that's really hard, because it sounds like you're creating a fake argument for yourself. You know what I mean? He hit me so hard because he really has no power left. That sounds like you're faking it. But that is, I believe, what really is happening. Now, BRICS still has a lot of wrinkles, right? As they expand, they have new members with new bricks in the wall, so to speak. You know, Lula's insistence on vetoing Venezuela. You know, what is that? I have no idea what that is. And I assume that, you know, Putin can say, well, yeah, we just agreed on that. But that's something, because that is now this, your, my upwind of hope is flattened a little bit by the, oh, okay. So they're not going to make this easy. They are going to exploit every crack and nook and cranny that they can find. They're going to do all sorts of things, because guess what? They do not want a solution where the dust settles and they take a different position on the food chain or on the hegemonic ladder. Really, what's the problem? And I think we've talked about this before, about the east-west kind of divide. Like, so what's the deal? You want 100 million, you can't have that. We need it 30, at least, okay? Then we can just chill and, you know, see how that works. And in another 10 years, maybe we can go at it again, and you can, and you have this, it's almost like they're human toddlers who will never outgrow that. No, we want it all. It's my cookie. And if you touched it, then I want yours too. And it is so crazy that it's, I mean, we see it here now. You've got to watch what's happening in this country too, Nima, because that, I believe, is part of what's going on. I think that this idea of to hell with the experts is universal, really do. It's not, it may be, it's collinear. It's not the same thing happening. I can't say that people who envision a Trump presidency as helpful in any way are reading the cards right, but they are telling all the people, this is the same as the yellow vests. This is the same as Brexit. It's the same as even AFD or even the Brotherhood in Italy. Like, these are right wing ideas and parties, but they represent a popular dissatisfaction with the status quo. And because it's being stifled and suffocated, and the only thing you can do to resist the status quo is to fight them on their grounds, it's fine. Okay, you're going to try to tell me who to vote for? I'll vote for the other guy. And I, in my humble prognostication, I think that Harris will lose. This is to my American viewers, they'll understand, by more than 100 electoral votes. That's my prediction. I think they have way, again, with this underestimation, the underestimation of the opponent, the idea that you are supreme, that you know all the answers, and the people who oppose you are stupid and underinformed. Well, on the battlefield, what you see is, I guess we were wrong, and now all our guys are dead, right? On the ballot box, you see, oh, I had no idea so many of them would vote against her or would vote for him, however you want to shape it. But I think it is, it's the cusp of a new reset. I really do. Even, I mean, it sounds weird when, because it, even when I say it, I have nothing, I have no interest in Trump at all. And it is sad how these people have created this. And what does that mean for Israel? What does it mean? I have Russian friends who said, well, he'll pull the plug on the Ukraine thing and just switch all those resources to Israel. But what do we see? Israel has U.S. cash to burn. They paved their roads with U.S. cash. And what has it done? It didn't get them through the air defenses in Tehran. And to say that the U.S. is somehow restraining Tel Aviv is ridiculous. That's just not true. They're arming them and may have provided airspace for them to attack. So, you know, that's just not happening.
Yeah. And the other thing, do you think right now with the Trump administration, if you believe that Trump would win in 2024, is that going to change his attitude? Are we going to see some sort of change in his attitude toward what's going on between the United States and on one side and Russia and Iran on the other side? Recently, J.D. Vance was talking about that we are not looking for a war with Iran. It's not in our interest to go in that direction. With Russia, they're claiming that they have the same kind of mindset. They want to put an end to the conflict in Ukraine. On one side, we are hearing that J.D. Vance is talking this way. Even Donald Trump is talking about Iran. He doesn't want a big war, a conflict, an escalation with Iran. On the other hand, you're hearing that he's talking about Mike Pompeo, Nikki Haley being part of the administration again. How can we put these two pictures together? It's all about, as Trump calls it, it's fake what he's talking about right now, and he's going to get back to the first administration, which was disastrous.
Well, what you see is fake in terms of appealing. You know, he knows that he has some pull with the idea that he didn't start any wars. Obama did. Biden did. And even though he certainly funded the Ukrainian disaster while it was happening, you know, as he was there, that was happening then. Plus, he was incredibly, threatening against Iran, and politically or verbally against China, that he loved to, you know, say with his idiot accent, and absolutely supportive of Israel. So all of those things are incredibly wrong if the anti-war crowd sees him as a safe bet, you know. And the problem with that is, although it may be just fake a thing to get votes and make sure he wins, is that Nikki Haley, Mike Pompeo, how much worse could it be? I mean, these people are, like I said, I was talking about Zbigniew Brzezinski. That's 45, 50 years ago, right? We're not talking about anything new in the whole spectrum of who is available to do the dirty work of the American system. Trump is not a threat in that regard to any extent that the current administration hasn't been. Now, I've written and spoken on this many times. I will say it here, and like I always have, every president is a war criminal, and every president is the worst one in history because it's current. The person who comes into office will be worse than the one who leaves, will do greater crimes against the human good, war crimes, because that's the path that they are on. There's no way that Harris could be better on Palestine, Israel, than Trump. That's a ridiculous idea. What evidence can you possibly point to, right? But on the other hand, it is silly to take it as something welcome that a Trump administration is going to usher in. The only thing, the reason I made my point about the overlap between the experts and F the status quo is there is a complete lack of control or anything in terms of what the American population has control over in terms of policy and running the system of government that has control over them. So expressing themselves through a ridiculous canard of an election that pretends to be democratic is a way for them to give a big middle finger to the system. It sounds juvenile even when I'm saying it. I get it. But the only thing that Trump is that I can say that I understand is a disruptor. He is a cog. A wrench in the cog of the wheel of American imperialism. Is he an opponent? Hardly. But he's the only person or the only political force. I wouldn't call him that. The only avenue through which there can be any bought time. This is about buying time for the world war. Really. The thermonuclear confrontation that Clinton and all the Obama acolytes and the pre-cons, neocons, post-cons, omnicons, anti-cons, what they all are aiming at, which is total control, total hegemony, and look at them. On the ground, they have zero chance. The only way they can win the war that they want is thermonuclear, because that's the only way in which they achieve the parity that they have lost. The generations in hypersonic and ballistic missile transfer, the defense, air defense, all of that level of technical supremacy that Russia has achieved, and they will do anything to bring that about, which I think that Americans and also other Western partners, it should scare the crap out of us. There is a real threat of nuclear confrontation that happens from this administration, of which Harris is half. And all of the people, forget Nikki Haley, forget Mike Pompeo, the people who are already being paid our money in tax dollars, who are already part of this game. They already believe it. They're already doing it. They are going ahead with it, and they want it badly. So will it be a change? I don't know. Is it what they want? Well, I think, you know, I can't. I'm not a prosecutor like Cackling Killer Cam or any of the Democrats who have launched, lawsuits against their opponents. But I can say that two attempts on the guy's life give you some idea of who wants him in power and who doesn't. I don't know that the CIA was behind any of that. There's no way we can ever prove that. But there is something, you see it in the press, you see it in the ads, you see it in the prickly kind of conversations that you have with people who think that Trump is an outright fascist, which is what they've called everybody. They've called everybody. Everybody who opposes them has been a fascist forever. I mean, this is the new Hitler du jour. And this is coming from a political party that slipped someone in without a single vote, no votes at all. And saying that this X has to be much better than Y is a little tough to swallow when you know all about Y and you don't know jack shit about X. You have no knowledge of what her beliefs are, what her policies are going to be. You know nothing. And to say that is inherently better than why is stupid. It really is. I don't, you know, I mean, I'm from Massachusetts. My vote doesn't mean anything anyway. I'll probably write in Fidel Castro, you know, but there is nothing that makes it so obvious that people are angry. People are very, even within, like an electorate as underinformed and completely oblivious to what our government is doing overseas, are so angry at the status quo and having things forced down their throats. You like this. You're going to like this. Ask your doctor. Ask the experts. You're going to take this. And if you don't, then you're stupid. You're probably from the South, and you're probably a racist and a Nazi and a Nazist and a racist and whatever other words we can make up. You're bad, and we're smart. We went to college. A lot of us went to Harvard. And you don't know. You don't know. We know. And I know, I know that's toddler-esque. I understand. And people are going to say, that is ridiculous. He's playing games. But that is, I think, the level on which this opposition takes place. And that's what makes it universal, Nima. That's what I'm saying, is that this plays into, wait a minute, Russia's not wrong. Wait a minute. They were wrong about the Soviet Union winning. How did we buy that lie for 50 years? How did we think that this army was going to be the best in the world when they haven't even won a war? They've never even fought a war, except in Vietnam. Oh, wait, that one didn't go so well. Afghanistan. Oh, yeah. And so I'm saying, once the mask is off, the shine is off, and people see right through it. Now, again, with the, clear, is it better or worse? It depends on how you're looking, what you're looking, what perspective you're looking from, what you're looking for. But things are getting clearer. How's that? That's a real deep sentiment, isn't it? Things are getting clearer. What's happening? I don't know, but things are getting clearer.
Thank you so much, Dan, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
And buenas noches. Okay.
Buenas noches. Bye-bye.